Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the June 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, when I open the phones to you, our listeners. One has to close one's eyes and ears to avoid the bad economic news coming from Europe. It seems to get worse on a daily basis. Last week, as expected, Spain asked for a $125 billion bailout from its fellow Eurozone members, and Italy, Europe's third-leading economy, appears on the brink of doing the same. 4 days from now, voters in Greece, the Eurozone's main basket case, whose economy and economic problems are of less significance, however, than either Spain or Italy, will be casting their ballots in an election that many observers predict will result in Greece dropping the euro altogether and returning to its original currency, the drachma. To talk about all of this and its impact on the U.S. economy and the upcoming presidential elections, I'll be speaking about 20 minutes past the hour with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Washington-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, who recently was in Spain observing that country's economic meltdown. Meanwhile, back on the ranch, Republicans in Congress have called for an investigation to determine who in the White House leaked two stories to the New York Times that have been classified top secret. One of them revealed that the U.S. working with Israel was behind the Stuxnet computer virus that apparently caused temporary setbacks to Iran's nuclear program, and that the decision to join Israel in that effort was the president's alone. The second article, which proved more controversial, described in detail how Obama personally supervises the U.S. drone program and is the one who decides who shall live and who shall die in the Pashtun areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan, as well as in Yemen and Somalia, all of which are home to what Washington perceives as terrorists, a name the administration applies to anyone of any age who forcefully resists the U.S. military presence in the region. The Republicans, led by Senator John McCain, himself an unindicted war criminal, claims that the Obama administration deliberately leaked those stories in the run-up to the November's election in order to portray the president as a tough guy, ready to do whatever is necessary to protect the U.S. and, of course, Israel's interest. And for once, I find myself agreeing with Senator McCain. By coincidence, the report of Obama's role in handpicking the targets for assassination appeared in the same issue of the San Francisco Chronicle as did a story about legendary folk singer Bob Dylan appearing at the White House to receive a Presidential Medal of Freedom from the hands of Obama, who may have signed someone's death warrant moments before. Mendocino County L.C. Lewis of Brook Trails, in a letter to last week's Anderson Valley Advertiser, noted that, quote, Mr. Dillon, in the photo of Mr. Obama, was wearing very dark glasses indoors. I guess, L.C. Lewis wrote, so Mr. Dillon will not have to look too closely and maybe remember the lyrics he wrote to Masters of War. I can see through your mask, end quote. Well, there's at least one Republican who has only praised the administration's drone program. That's Congress's most prominent Islamophobe, Peter King from New York. There's evil people in the world, King told CNN on Sunday. Drones aren't evil. People are evil. We are a force of good, and we are using those drones to carry out the policy of righteousness and goodness, end quote. To continue carrying out Congressman King's wishes and claiming that is seeking to reduce civilian casualties and collateral damage, the Pentagon will soon deploy a new generation of drones the size of model planes, packing tiny explosive warheads that can be delivered with pinpoint accuracy. The new Switchblade drone weighs less than 6 pounds and can take out a sniper on a rooftop without blasting the building to bits. According to an article in Monday's LA Times, it also enables soldiers in the field to identify and destroy targets and much more quickly by eliminating the need to call in a strike from a large drone that may be hundreds of miles away. This is a precision strike weapon that causes as minimal damage as possible, said William Nichols, who led the Army's testing effort of the drones at Redstone Arsenal near Huntsville, Alabama. The 2-foot-long Switchblade is so named because its wings fold to the fuselage for transport and spring out after launch. It's designed to fit into a soldier's rucksack and is fired from a mortar-like tube. Once airborne, it begins sending back live video and GPS coordinates to a handheld control set clutched by the soldier who launched it. Following the discourse at the U.S. behind the Stuxnet computer virus, Richard Lardner reported in Bloomberg Businessweek that the Homeland Security Department is, quote, warning American businesses about an unusually potent computer virus that infected Iran's oil industry, even as suspicions persist that the United States is responsible for secretly creating and unleashing cyber weapons against foreign countries, which they've now admitted. Or not admitted, but it's been revealed. The government's dual roles of alerting U.S. companies, he goes on, about these threats, while at the same time producing powerful software weapons and eavesdropping tools, underscore the risk of an unintended online boomerang and are a challenge facing the programmers who build such weapons and presidents who must decide when to launch them, end quote. The White House has declined to discuss the virus. Obama, who assured the failure of the last diplomatic round with Iran by telling Tehran that there would be no let-up in sanctions in return for any concession it might make, is still following Netanyahu and AIPAC's orders by escalating the pressure on Iran and making sure our allies do the same. On Monday, he exempted seven more countries from U.S. sanctions that will be placed on any nation doing business with Iran when they come into force at the end of the month, and left open the prospect that China could still face U.S. sanctions. According to the State Department, Turkey, India, Taiwan, South Korea, Malaysia, South Africa, and Sri Lanka had all reduced their purchases of Iranian oil by enough to be given a six-month exemption from the sanctions, which was going into effect on the 28th of June. Japan and 10 European countries have already been awarded similar exemptions. The evidence suggests that these countries are probably more afraid of the catastrophic economic fallout from an Israeli attack on Iran, as well as U.S. sanctions against them, than they are from Iran developing a nuclear weapon. But if the President of the United States has surrendered his decision-making powers to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, and he is prepared to punish them if they don't go along with him in sticking it to Iran, what choice do they have in the matter? As for the president, his behavior could be characterized as treasonous, and one day it very well might be. As further evidence of that and Washington's duplicity in dealing with Iran, on May 21st, 2 days before the talks between representatives from Tehran and the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, administration officials headed by Vice President Joe Biden, a self-declared Zionist, met with 70 members of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations in a series of closed-door meetings and stressed their intention to maintain a tough stance during talks with Iran, according to the Jerusalem Post. The story did not make the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, or the Washington Post. According to those who attended the meeting, the officials said that the U.S. had no plan to reduce sanctions during the talks, and that it was their firm expectation that the EU would still be imposing an oil embargo on Iran at the beginning of July with no exemptions for British shipping insurance. At the same time, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, a think tank founded by AIPAC in 1985 to better manipulate U.S. Middle East policy, a fact that the mainstream media keeps from its readers and viewers, and in the case of NPR, its listeners, well, it's published a position paper titled Iran's Likely Responses to an Israeli Preventive Strike, in which it postulates that, quote, Iran's initial response to an Israeli preventive strike would likely be to lash out Israeli and Jewish targets while seeking to avoid a broader conflict with the United States or its Gulf Arab neighbors, end quote. This opinion is in conflict with what most seasoned Middle East observers, not enthralled to Israel or AIPAC, believe, but notice the language. Preventive strike. Everything Israel has done from its founding, its leaders and supporters will tell you, has been preventive, including the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 of Palestinians from their homeland in 1948, because their presence would have made the establishment of a Jewish state virtually impossible. Now the Washington Institute sees its task as softening up the public and the media for an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, and if it goes wrong and economic disaster follows, it won't be held to account, as it wasn't after cheerleading for the war in Iraq. And having mentioned Israel's ethnic cleansing operation in 1948, which required the destruction of more than 400 Palestinian villages, it should be noted that it didn't end there. The Israeli daily Haaretz has published a report revealing that Israel revoked the residency rights of around 240,000 Palestinians from the time it occupied the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem in 1967 until the Palestinian Authority was established in 1994 after Oslo. It stated more than 140,000 Palestinian residents of the West Bank and more than 100,000 from Gaza lost their residency rights in that 27-year period. The report also indicated that the natural growth of the Palestinian population is around 3.3%, but the strict Israeli measures on border terminals reduced the Palestinian population by more than 10%, most of whom are college students who studied abroad or who had traveled to or worked in several countries, including the Arab Gulf. The Israelis have a term for that. They call it voluntary transfer. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, has said that the U.S. administration has threatened to cut off aid to the Palestinian Authority if the authority seeks UN recognition as a non-member state. The Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO Bureau in Washington, would also be closed down, according to Erekat. If Palestine is granted such status, it would make it an occupied country instead of disputed territories, as Israel claims. UN recognition would also confirm further the illegality of Israel's settlements. According to a report in the Saudi Arabian newspaper Okaz, Erekat said that Israel has not left any room for negotiations and has ruined the option of the two-state solution, although many observers on both sides of the conflict believe that option vanished some time ago. Erekat has said that going to the United Nations General Assembly after the PA's failure to obtain member status from the Security Council would empower the Palestinian position at the international level. We can be sure that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has already instructed his vassal in the White House and his agents inside and outside of Congress not to let that happen. Well, now let's turn our sights on Africa, where on Friday, the Army Times reported that a U.S. Army brigade will deploy to Africa next year in a pilot program that assigns brigades on a rotational basis to regions around the globe. According to the article, roughly 3,000 soldiers, and likely more, are expected to serve tours across the continent in 2013, training foreign militaries and aiding locals, as part of a quote-unquote regionally aligned force concept. Soldiers will live and work among Africans in safe communities approved by the U.S. government, said Major General David R. Hogg, head of U.S. Army Africa. The article goes on to describe how soldiers who wish to serve on the continent can do so. Well, first, they can volunteer for duty with U.S. Army Africa, join an Office of Security Cooperation for the region, not sure what that is, or apply and become a foreign area officer. According to General Hogg, tours can last a few weeks or months and include multiple missions at different locations. The Army Times, now owned by Gannett, has had close ties to the military since it began publishing in 1940. How it describes a forthcoming U.S. penetration of Africa is worth paying attention to because it's the way the story will no doubt be fed to the public when it's deemed time for them to hear it. As the Afghanistan war winds down, the article tells its largely military audience, the new readiness model affords Army units more time to learn regional cultures and languages and train for specific threats and missions. Africa in particular, it says, has emerged as a greater priority for the U.S. government because terrorist groups there have been an increasing threat to U.S. and regional security. Though U.S. soldiers have operated in Africa for decades, including more than 1,200 soldiers currently stationed at Camp Le Monnier, Djibouti, that's on the Horn of Africa, the region in many ways remains the Army's last frontier. As far as the mission goes, it's uncharted territory, Hogg said from his headquarters in Vicenza, Italy. But I'm not there to win their hearts. I'm not there to win their wars or settle their differences, he added. Instead, with more soldiers, the article goes on to say, U.S. Army Africa will continue to strengthen ties with regional militaries and governments by teaching military tactics, medicine, and logistics, as well as combating famine, disease, and terrorism in secure environments, end quote. With those might be, the article alludes to by noting that, quote, the Army currently allows conventional soldiers to enter only 46 of the 54 African states due to security risks, and that the State Department and U.S. Special Operations Command handle activities in the other countries, including those amid conflict. Active duty soldiers, guardsmen, and reservists have helped quell regional violence and assist sick and injured Africans and feed the famished in East Africa, it points out, and quote, during a recent annual training exercise, U.S. soldiers taught Ugandan forces how to deliver supplies by air to comrades in the bush chasing rebels from the Lord's Resistance Army, a militia accused of atrocities in Central Africa. And U.S. soldiers have also trained African troops headed for peacekeeping missions in Somalia on convoy security and countering improvised explosive devices. The Army has no plans to construct permanent bases across the continent, and the mission does not have its limits. General Hogg said. For all the challenges that happen and sprout up across Africa, it really comes down to, it has to be an African solution. We are here to enable, where wanted, the African forces to figure out and solve their own problems, said Hogg, who has visited more than 20 countries. That's from Friday's Army Times. Curiously, there was no mention of how this mission relates to AFRICOM, the relatively new U.S.-Africa command, but we can assume that it will be a critical part of it. The last word comes from Vietnam vet Larry Nosker, who was interviewed by Time Magazine's Joe Klein in North Carolina a couple of weeks ago, and who suggested that every incumbent be defeated in the next election as the capital be moved from Washington, D.C. to someplace in America. Said Nosker, quote, the Republicans have money and flaunt it,